Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is, and it's been a long time coming, we haven't done one of these in God knows how many years, this is a Practical Evidence podcast, and this is the first Practical Evidence podcast I actually have a guest on. Who are you?
Hey, I'm Jeremy Faust. I am an attending physician at Brigham and Women's in Boston and at Harvard Medical School.
And the reason I brought Jeremy on is because I've been doing a bunch of work with him on sepsis and the various sepsis guidelines, and he's really taken the lead on figuring this stuff out. So he's the perfect person to discuss our topic for today, the new 2016, even though they weren't published till 2017, Surviving Sepsis Campaign Guidelines. And we'll go through them, we'll tell you what you need to know, and we'll editorialize because that's what we do. Jeremy is also half of the hosting package of Foamcast, a podcast about FOAM, Free Open Access Medical Education. You can find it at foamcast.org. Along with his partner, Lauren Westerford, they go over the current evidence and the things of interest to you. They just recently did an episode on this very topic, so you could check that out. But instead of referring you to their show, I just brought Jeremy on to re-record. But their show is still worth listening to on this topic, so just go to foamcast.org or just go to the show notes for this episode and you'll find a link to their episode there as well. Jeremy, how do you feel about these guidelines in general?
Well, I think that they're interesting for two main reasons, what we'll get into. One is just a major breaking news that they're really pulling away from early goal-directed therapy for the first time. This is in line with all of the best evidence we know about, but it is you have to acknowledge it's a moment because this is the group that really pushed this as a protocol that everyone ought to be doing. So I think that this is an appropriate guideline. There's some bells and whistles that are interesting, and I think it's progress.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one. Let's get right into it. So the first thing you have to ask is, these are guidelines for patients who are septic and have septic shock. What do they define those two words as in these guidelines?
So this comes back to about a year ago when the sepsis 3.0 came out, and they have adapted those definitions. They are saying, look, sepsis is not just the old thing we thought of, an infection with some SIRS. Sepsis is dysregulation. It's a dysregulated response to infection that leads to badness, that leads to death. And then septic shock is the subset of those folks who have other hemodynamic parameters that is so bad that they have a much higher chance of dying. So they have basically said as a construct that the sepsis 3.0 definition is what they're going to go with. And on top of that, they're really not weighing in on any criteria for that. So they're not weighing in on Q-SOFA or SOFA. They're not weighing in on what level of lactate. They're just sort of saying, here's the construct.
Though my reading of it would be that they are basically just whole cloth adopting sepsis 3.0. And in fact, I was almost surprised by how little attention was paid to this entire huge controversial thing. And maybe that was quite deliberate. But they basically just said in a tiny little paragraph as to who these guidelines apply to, just figured out through sepsis 3.0. Which probably would indicate to the, I think most readers that you do adopt those new criteria, at least for septic shock, which means persistent hypotension requiring vasopressors and, keyword and, a lactate greater than 2.0.
Yeah, and I think somewhere in this document, there is a pretty, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a pretty straightforward place where they say lactate of greater than 4, or they use that or to say in their mind, septic shock is simply lactate greater than 4. Now, that's something that we've argued with others about a lot.
Oh, that's interesting. We'll have to look at that, and we'll put the exact wording of that section in the show notes because maybe I missed that one, but that would be super interesting. Okay, so assuming you have a patient who is septic or in septic shock according to those new 3.0 definitions, they make some recommendations about your care and diagnosis and such. And the first thing to talk about then is fluids. What are the current 2016 and 2017 recs for fluid?
So basically, they are in some ways changed in the sense that they're kind of lengthening the period of time that the fluid has to go in, 3 hours, but they're sticking with their 30 cc's per kg bolus. Now, of course, in the old trials, it was 20 to 30 cc's. They have stuck with 30 for some reason. And again, rather than just pushing it through, they're saying over 3 hours it can go, and that's your bolus.
Yeah, and this is interesting from a number of perspectives. One, we know, and these folks have been featured on MCRIT numerous times, folks like Paul Marek, my friends in Australia, they don't believe that every patient requires 30 mLs per kg, and they, I think, make pretty definitive arguments about why some patients don't. This is reasonable, but but maybe it's still a little bit lacking in evidence. And in fact, that was noted because they're using the GRADE criteria, which probably is the best way of doing guidelines right now. And they make this as a strong rec with low quality evidence. So you always wonder about those. What else do they say about fluids, Jeremy?
Well, for one thing, the reassessment piece is probably the breaking news. And that is that they're basically buying into the Jones approach, which is you can use lactate. And also they're buying into the approach that I think came out in the CMS compromise, which is dynamic reassessment of fluid status is the way to go. They are no longer recommend CVP as the way to do this. They're basically saying you don't need to do early goal-directed therapy approach to fluid resuscitation. It's just out.
Absolutely. Though they say it's not harmful. And if you're still doing it, you'd probably be within the guidelines, I think, if you read between the lines. But they say you don't need to do it. Is that fair?
That's correct. And I think that's some lip service. And I think that's just saying, look, there's a variety of practice in this country and in the world. And these are all safe ways to go.
Sure. Now, they do recommend later on in the guidelines fluid challenges to determine additional necessity of fluid in addition to the dynamic assessment means. And that sounds good on its face, though, again, those same people on MCRIT will very vociferously argue that even if a patient responds to a fluid challenge, whether that be by clinical means or actually monitoring cardiac output, that doesn't mean it's sticking around for anything greater than 20, 30 minutes, an hour at most, and therefore may still be deleterious even though the patient had an initial response. They don't dwell on that, though. They recommend crystalloids as the initial fluid resuscitation choice. And then they had some warning about albumin. What did they say, Jeremy?
Well, basically, they're sort of hemming and hawing. They say that if the patient is going to need a lot of fluids, like tons, then basically there is maybe some weak evidence suggesting that adding albumin may be helpful. They're basing this on a handful of trials, including the Albios trial, which to my read was a subgroup analysis at best showed benefit there, but you probably know more on that than I do.
Yeah, and I think their recommendations on this is fair, and I say that as someone biased because I kind of like giving albumin after I've given a ton of crystalloids, if for the reason only that it makes your eyes and O's look far more delightful than tons and tons of fluid. As to whether that benefits the patient, in patient-important outcomes, I don't think we know yet. But it's probably the practice of most critical care practitioners. What's our MAP goal in this one?
Well, they stuck with 65. And of course, there's been a little bit of, over the years, some weirdness about that. At the NQF, the measure that led into the CMS measure, somehow 70 got in there. But then eventually the CMS measure by which hospitals will eventually have to abide in this country, it's back to 65, and they stuck with that here.
And that's probably reasonable, and that's probably what the best evidence shows. Okay, so Jeremy, they have some rec about normalizing lactate. What do they say?
Well, basically, they're adopting the approach that you want to use lactate as a marker of hypoperfusion. So basically, you can say if this patient is having an appropriate fluid resuscitation, then you're going to see that in a requisite drop in lactate, and that's good.
Yeah, and they recommend normalizing the lactate. What they don't say to do, and I think it's very clear that you shouldn't be doing this, is keep giving fluid in an attempt to get that lactate down. That wasn't recommended by them, and you shouldn't be doing that unless you have a really clear vision in your mind that the patient is hypovolemic. And the other thing they do, I'm not sure if it was in the most recent iteration before this one, but they're very clear that lactate is not solely a marker of tissue hyperperfusion. It could be from all the changes in glycolysis and all the things we know. So they were very clear here. They understand lactate, but they are quite correct in stating if your lactate is high, that's associated with a higher chance of dying. And in a bunch of studies, if you could get the lactate to come down, then that's associated with better mortality.
Right. And I think what you're getting at here is something that Paul Merrick has been really, really polemicizing about for a long time, which is lactate itself isn't bad, but it's a prognosticator in some way.
Exactly right. Okay. They recommend having hospital-based protocols to find septic patients and to treat them. And I don't think anyone could argue with that, but I'm not sure if there's any real evidence for it. Did they have any additional wording about that that I'm forgetting?
No, not at all. But what I would say is it kind of sneaks in there. But to be honest, to me, that is actually the take-home message of the three major trials of 2014. It's like find the sick, have a protocol in place to find the sick patients and deliver critical care to those people.
You're exactly right. And I've made the argument to people who are kind of panning our take on this, that if you made any quality initiative that simply found septic patients, like gave a crap about them and then put them on a bed where someone watched them every now and then, they would have identical outcomes to any other quality initiative based on bundles.
Yeah, and I think the Greater Hospital New York approach was that, was it not? It was basically every hospital has to develop a guideline that they want to follow.
Yep, exactly right. Okay, blood cultures. And I find it delicious the way they stated this here and in contrast to our work on CMS. What did they say about blood cultures? If I'm remembering correctly, they basically said, get them before antibiotics if clinically feasible, but if it's going to delay antibiotics, give the antibiotics first and get the blood cultures when you can. Is that right?
I can't resist talking about this. The CMS measure that is in place in this country would actually tell you that if you drew blood cultures 1 minute after you administered antibiotics, you would fail the measure, and you would your hospital, when this becomes something that's tied to reimbursement, which may come in the future, would actually get dinged because you gave vancomycin and cefepime, and then 1 minute later you put a blood culture, you took a blood culture. That just seems crazy to me.
That's exactly right. And just to really emphasize that, the current measure we have in the United States is an all or nothing measure. So if you followed the surviving sepsis guidelines and didn't delay antibiotic therapy because getting blood cultures at this exact minute were not feasible, you'd be complying with the international guidelines and you would fail the entire United States measure.
Correct.
Okay, let's talk about antibiotics. They have a recommendation for timing of antibiotics here. What is that recommendation?
So their basic recommendation is as soon as possible and within 1 hour for both sepsis and septic shock. Now, of course, we have to remind ourselves that what they mean by sepsis is what we used to think of as severe sepsis. So, you know, the real deal sepsis now, which I think we can agree upon. So, but they're still saying that for both of these guys, 1 hour is where they want it to be within. And that is tricky.
It's tricky. Why?
Well, it's tricky because I think mountains of evidence would suggest that for patients who are already in septic shock, that is evidence-based. These patients have a sort of time is life sort of thing with respect to the administration of antibiotics IV. With severe sepsis, or what we now call sepsis, that evidence is not there. There are lots of trials looking at that. Most of them are low quality. The ones that I think are the most compelling are the ones that say, A, it doesn't make a difference. And in some cases, and I think, Scott, you could expand on this, there's actually possibly some harm there.
Yeah, the ID societies kind of hated the United States measure for this reason, in that the and look, you look at this and you're like, oh, well, of course, why wouldn't I want to give antibiotics to a patient I think is septic? Of course, we give that antibiotics to patients with pneumonia within an hour. Why wouldn't we do this? And what these people are failing to understand is that's never the problem. It's the problem with the patient who is difficult to identify, who doesn't get identified for a while due to all the complexities of taking care of patients with multiple different problems or complicated presentations. Essentially, the only way to make these kind of things happen is just to, you know, shotgun antibiotics on any patient who has even the remotest chance of turning out to be septic or severe sepsis. That being said, with the sepsis 3.0 definitions, I feel a lot better about this recommendation than I would with the current United States guideline recommendations, which is SIRS plus infection plus any of these signs of organ dysfunction, which could be as simple as one reading of hypotension that never recurs, and those patients would be deemed requiring these antibiotics within these short time periods.
Right, and that could be a lactate of 2.1 or 2.2 in their regime, which is kind of crazy. And the other problem is, and I agree with what you're saying, that the sort of acknowledgement that they should be using the sepsis 3.0 for the inclusion criteria for this recommendation is very, very good. But the IDSA made this point, and I think we made it in our paper in EM Clinics North America. If you have a patient who comes in looking like they're truly septic, but they're not in septic shock, and actually they've been on, say, oral antibiotics for a while, and so you're hearing, okay, this patient has, like, they look terrible, and they're having tons of diarrhea, and this is obviously C. difficile. Actually, unless you have a proven culture to say that, CMS says, nope, you still have to give broad spectrum antibacterials, which to my mind will make it worse because C. diff is caused by those agents, right? So what you really need in those cases is something like PO vancomycin or Flagyl, but unless you actually have a culture to prove it, they won't let you do it. So that's a problem. If you maybe had a couple hours or a few hours to prove that, that'd be great. But by enforcing this within 1 hour, you might end up making it worse.
Sure. And are the CMS timelines the same 1 hour? I thought we had more time for that.
The CMS timeline is 3 hours, right. for this. But the point is, this is actually where it gets interesting. Sometimes you have the CMS guideline, which you may or may not have to follow right now, and we very well will have to follow in the future unless something's done about that. And then you have things like this, which are sort of, you know, this surviving sepsis campaign guideline doesn't have any teeth. It's just a guideline.
Yep, absolutely right. Okay, let's move on to vasopressors. I think this is a change from their previous recs, though I don't think it changes practice very much if you follow their previous recs. What are they saying about the choice of vasopressors?
Well, the biggest thing is, you know, Levofed, norepinephrine, that's your first line. And after that, epi and vasopressin. And I don't think this is too controversial in the sense that if you want to basically go to those other agents to decrease your the dose that they're on of Levofed, norepinephrine, that's reasonable. So basically, that's their three-pronged approach.
Yeah, and so they're saying vaso primarily if you want your levo dose down, or they have persistent hypotension. But it seems like, and this might be an intonation I'm just reading into it, that epi seems to be more recommended for a patient you can't get to a MAP of 65. Is that a correct interpretation?
Yeah, that's right. And they actually, I think in the final version of the guideline, they sort of put epi and vasopressin on the same line. But in the drafts, I'll tell you that I saw going into this, it was very clearly epinephrine is next. So, you know, they kind of hemmed and hawed on that. But this is kind of, you know, as a non-ICU provider, I will tell you, this is where we get a little bit in the weeds and we call up people like you and say, hey, what do you think?
Yeah, and I think whichever one you went with, I think it's pretty clear in my mind, this is not in the guidelines, but it's pretty clear. If you throw an echo on the heart and the heart is thrumming away, then maybe vaso is your choice. But if that heart's not doing what it's supposed to be doing, it makes a lot more sense to make your second line agent something with an inotropic component. And so I'd add epi to my norepi. Let's talk about, oh, and I should just mention there, dopamine is really dead now. I mean, they will not write dopamine is dead, but the way they worded the guidelines, it's pretty clear. Stop using dopamine. Am I reading that correctly, Jeremy?
Yeah, and you know, if you want to use an inotrope, they do say that dobutamine's okay.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, steroids. What are their current recs on steroids?
So steroid recs are basically only do so if you absolutely have to. That's the way I read it as a non-ICU physician who actually treats septic patients a lot. And they're saying that IV hydrocortisone is the way you'd go with that. And that's only in a patient who is being adequately resuscitated and who just is not getting hemodynamic stability. That's the sort of narrow recommendation. It's pretty weak, and it's a low quality of evidence, and I think you could add to that.
Yeah, I would interpret it differently based on my own biases, as keep using exactly as many of us are the Anon idea of steroids, which is you shouldn't be giving it to any patient on a vasopressor. You should be giving it to a patient adequately volume resuscitated on a hefty dose of vasopressor who's still not meeting your MAP goals. So for me, if I'm on norepi of 20 and I've given them adequate fluid and the patient still is like a MAP of 62 and I'm considering adding on another vasopressor or doing other stuff, I give them steroids. And I think the guidelines are consistent with that viewpoint.
Fair enough. And then the question is, did they get etomidate or not?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of it's become kind of a non-issue until someone does a study that shows it definitively. And, you know, an issue that I think has been solved currently by the guidelines, I really emphatically, is when to give blood. So what do they say about that?
Yeah, and this is not that different from the last guideline, I think. And that is basically that it's the threshold to give blood should be pretty strict. So 7.0 grams per deciliter in adults, basically. And, you know, back in the day, it was higher than that. And we've in other disease processes, we've heard similar things that the sort of more conservative this more conservative strategy is just the safer one. There's some caveats. If the patient's got clear myocardial ischemia or they're hypoxemic, you know, from here to the high water, then obviously it's different. Or if they're hemorrhaging, for goodness sake, like replete them. But I don't think that's too controversial, but it's nice that they're sort of, this is a safety parameter, if anything.
Sure. And I think we'll be seeing some studies this year that will show even in patients with a history of CAD or active ischemia that's not a STEMI, you still will use 7. But those are still just being talked about as coming out. We'll see what the real results are when they're published. Okay, mechanical ventilation, an area I'm not sure why they delved into because it just opens them up to a host of possibilities of things changing from new studies that will make their guidelines outdated in this mode. They could have just said, you know, we recommend lung protective strategies for mechanical ventilation, and they would have been well served. But all their recs they made on this, I totally agree with. So what do they say about mechanical ventilation? I'll summarize it just to get us through this. They recommend ARDS-NET for ARDS patients who have sepsis, so low tidal volume, 6 mLs per kg at the most, and a plateau of 30. They make a tentative recommendation for patients without ARDS to use low tidal volumes, which I agree with, and they recommend putting the head of bed up. And we can just leave it there. You can look at the actual document if you want to know more. Okay, what's their glucose rec? Okay, let's also just quickly get through glucose. They have not in any way varied their perspective on it, that you do not need ultra-tight glucose control like we were doing for many years, and it was torture. It's 180 is your number. If they're greater than 180, you should put them on an insulin drip or some form of insulin. And again, the recs are there for, if you have it available, ARTLINE glucose monitoring may be more accurate in critically ill patients than capillary finger stick glucoses. Okay, what do they say about bicarb?
Basically, don't.
I wish that's what they said. They said don't if your pH is greater than 7.15. Now, if they had made the cutoff don't unless your pH is greater than 6.9, I think it would make more sense. And they don't say you have to give it if it's less than 7.15, but they just backed away from those patients. They said we don't have great study data on those extremely low, to their mind. I don't call 7.15 extremely low. I just call it a little bit low. But they just say don't do it if they're greater than or equal to 7.15.
Yeah, and that's basically been my approach to almost any physiologic pathway that gets you down towards 7. You know, DKA is sort of the same thing. It's like you could actually argue maybe when they dip into the 6s that bicarb might be a clever move, or you could argue that it's not. But I think, yeah, 7.15, I've never even considered doing that, so I was sort of surprised.
Fair enough. Stress ulcer prophylaxis, they basically say you don't need to give it unless the patient has risk factors such as mechanical ventilation for greater than 48 hours or coagulopathy. We'll just leave it there. And that's enough. There's more in the guidelines that I didn't discuss just because I didn't find them that interesting or significantly changed from prior, but the entire document is over at the show notes for this. So Jeremy, that covers basically the stuff I think our listeners will care about for these guidelines, but I think you have some additional summary thoughts. Why don't you tell us what you think?
Yeah, so the whole idea, I thought this is fascinating because the whole idea of pulling away from the protocolized approach. So the Surviving Sepsis campaign has actually said, our previous bundles are not included in this, and here's a bunch of things that we think are evidence-based to do to treat sepsis. And that's amazing because, in a sense, the Surviving Sepsis campaign made its mark on medicine in the early 2000s by adopting the approach of the IHI and the To Err as Human came out in the late 90s saying we have all these medical errors. And basically there was two approaches to fixing that. And one is accountability, that is report your data. And the other one is let's have protocols. And what's amazing is now we've kind of come full circle where this organization that was rolling out a protocol in order to decrease medical errors is now saying, yeah, the protocols that we've been talking about for the last, you know, half decade and a half, not that necessary.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's definitely a sea change. So let's get to the most important part of the Practical Evidence podcast, which is what is MCRIT drinking? And right now, I have switched from beer and wine for this podcast, just temporarily, to cider. Cideries in the United States are having a boom. We're really getting to the point where we're as good as some of the international ciders out there. Traditionally, we've been just as crappy as the UK ciders. I know I'm going to get shit for that, and there are amazing ciders in the UK. But most of what's drunk in the United States and the UK, if you go to a bar, is crappy, sweet apple juice. But now we have a resurgence of artisanal cideries. And I am drinking the Pack Basket Cider from South Hill Cider. It's available online. It's amazing. Jeremy, what are you drinking?
So I'm going to be a little out of the box here and tell you what I'm making at home because I had this realization that my wife and I were spending tons of money going out to restaurants, but all we really wanted from that Mexican restaurant was a margarita. And so I have learned how to make a margarita, and it's beautiful. As long as you just get 100% agave tequila, and I recommend a 2-to-1 ratio with that and Cointreau, okay? And you can actually use any mix you want. You don't have to do your own lime juice. You can buy the Trader Joe's lime. And basically, it's like twice as much tequila and one unit of Cointreau, one unit of mixer. You can throw some grapefruit juice, some ginger beer, and then you got to salt the rim. And that to me, is fun. I'm tweaking it. And then once you know how to make that, you can also make a daiquiri. So this is my economic gift to you, is make your own margaritas at home.
Okay. So I like your intent, but what you've said is blasphemous. Do not, listeners of the Practical Evidence podcast, ever use a mix, ever. Fucking buy a lime and cut it up and squeeze it into your mixer. There is no reason to get these mixes. They are overly sweet. They are garbage. Do not do it. Make your margarita with good tequila, a excellent orange liqueur, and fucking lime.
Okay, so I'm going to just say that my previous recommendation was weak recommendation with weak evidence, but I think Scott has a stronger opinion on that.
Well, I have a louder recommendation, as I always do. All right, Jeremy, I can't thank you enough for coming on the podcast, and I'm glad you are the first guest on the Practical Evidence podcast.
It's a pleasure and an honor, Scott.